From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Eric Larson says he first started reading about the Lusitania like a lot of people did, on a whim. The Lusitania was a massive 800-foot ocean liner that was torpedoed and sunk by a German U-boat during World War I. Larson says he was horrified by the story, of course, but also charmed by it, and so he kept digging and digging to learn as much as he could. And what he found, he says in his new book, is a very good story. A story with intriguing characters and courage and love and dumb luck, and there may be a conspiracy in here, too. He says it's myriad forces that converged on one spring day in 1915 to produce a tragedy of monumental scale. Eric Larson will join us today to talk about his book, Dead Wake. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You may know some of the story of the British passenger ocean liner, the Lusitania. It was a huge ship and fast, and it was torpedoed by a German U-boat during World War I. The U-boat put one torpedo in her hull, and she went down in 18 minutes. Nearly 1,200 passengers and crew died. And it was a bright, beautiful spring afternoon. It was May 7th of 1915, and so some of the passengers, those who happened to be on deck, actually saw the torpedo coming. They could see this track. It's a disturbance that the writer Eric Larson says lingered on the surface of the calm water that day. In his new book, he describes it as looking like a long, pale scar. It's what they called the dead wake. Some of the passengers may have been terrified, but Larson says for many, there wasn't really fear as much as astonishment that the Germans would actually do it, even though they said they would. It just seemed inconceivable that anything could bring down the Lusitania. And that's part of the story that Eric Larson knew when he started all of this, but the more he dug into the story, and this is something he does in all of his work, an incredible amount of research, the more he dug in, he realized it wasn't really the story that he knew about. And that's the story he tells in his book. Again, Dead Wake is the title. He, of course, is the author of a number of books, including The Devil in the White City and In the Garden of Beasts. He's joining us today from a studio in Mobile, Alabama. It's where he's on a sort of a pit stop in between destinations for this book tour. The book, by the way, has just come out in paperback. And Eric Larson, welcome. Thanks very much for
doing
this.
Thank you.
I wanted to begin before we jump into this particular story. What is it? I know you've talked about this before, but what is it that interests you about history? What's the thing
about history? Yeah. Well, just about everything. I it's more complicated than that. I come to historical subjects from a journalistic perspective, not necessarily that of a historian. And my goal in coming to history is to produce as rich and visceral a sense of moments in history as I possibly can. And using all the things that I've learned as a journalist and as a writer generally, so it's not necessarily because it's history, but because there's this opportunity to do something that is so compelling for contemporary readers.
You once said that the goal isn't necessarily to inform. The goal is to, and this is how you put it, create an historical experience.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. And now, when I say my goal isn't to inform, that doesn't mean that. I mean, you know, if you want to use my books in your PhD thesis, you go right ahead. The information is good. It's all nonfiction. That's fine. You know, go wild, cite away. But paradoxically, it is not my intent to necessarily to inform. It is to produce that historical experience. My goal is that a reader start reading one of my books and ideally sink, no pun intended, but ideally sink into the past in a very rich, deep way and emerge with a sense of maybe having been aboard, in this case, the ship, you know, to try to capture a sense of the past that's different than what might come from that reading, you know, sort of a standard history.
We'll come back to this, but one of the things that struck me, I have to say, about reading the book in terms of the experience, and this is just one of many details, obviously, but the coal dust that was kind of everywhere, as you said, seeping under doors and in locks and on railings, that was something that really came to life for me.
Well, yeah, for me too. And of course, we're talking about the coal dust that seeps under the doors and so forth when the ship is being loaded with coal. The thing about the Lusitania is that it's not really bait and switch, but it's kind of like, you know, if you were to encounter the Lusitania at its wharf in New York, you would see this gigantic, sleek, elegant, gorgeous vessel. Just even standing still, it looked like it was moving. It was just such a lovely design. But when you think about if you knew how the thing was powered and what happened in the bowels of the ship, it's a very different picture. It's almost like some kind of portrait, you know, of hell, really. Yeah. I mean, yeah. There's just vast amounts of coal and this multitude of furnaces that had to be stoked by hand by the so-called Black Gang, which is not a reference to race, but really just to the fact that these guys, by the time that their shifts were over, they were just covered with soot. But when the ships were being loaded with coal, coal tends to yield a good deal of dust, and this very, very fine dust would sift onto various surfaces where it wasn't supposed to sift, including like fine china, and railings and so forth. And that was kind of an eye-opener to me as well.
You've said that nonfiction satisfies these two elements of your personality. There's the telling of the story part. I get that. But the digging part, the research part, seems like almost as much a part of the fun for you in some way.
Oh, it very much is. You know, I'm often asked if I have staff, you know, and I'm never quite sure if they mean, you know, do I have people who work for me or do I have the infection? But, you know, it's like, do I have staff? No, I do all the research by myself because it is fun. I mean, the reason I love this so much is because I'm doing – it's not just one thing that I do. It's two phases really. There's the research phase and the writing phase. And the research is really a lot of fun for me because, you know, once you know you're on the case, if you will, it's like every day really is sort of like a detective story, you know. Mm-hmm. And plus throw in the fact that, yes, it's a detective story, but also I get to go to all these cool places.
Right.
Like when I was researching Dead Wake, because I hate to fly, and I was living in Seattle at the time, and any flight to the UK would be like an 11-hour ordeal, you know.
Yeah.
Because of that, my wife and I, she was able to set up a sabbatical, so we based ourselves in Paris. Now, of course, you just may ask, well, okay, why Paris if you've got to do all this research in the United Kingdom? And then my answer to that is, well, Paris, you know. I mean,
it's Paris.
Plus the fact that the channel is an amazing thing. It's
true.
Very, very quick.
You don't have to fly.
So. You don't have to fly. And so you know, so it's not just the research. It's just the experience. It's also the experience of being in all these very interesting places and encountering very interesting people. I mean, the archives of the UK, for example, I mean, it's just such an amazing place. You know, you can be sitting at your table going through your materials and somebody in another table nearby might be unspooling an Elizabethan scroll, you know, with the help of archivists. But that, you know, it's that kind of experience.
So what was it when you first – you've talked about that you first sort of encountered the story of the Lusitania like a lot of us do, kind of on a whim. Oh, interesting. So at what point –
It wasn't so much a whim as it was that I was – the idea search for me is a very hard time. And I always start with a blank slate. And in this case, I had come up completely dry and I was just thinking about the Lusitania because it had always been vaguely on my list. And so therefore, yes, more or less on a whim in that context, I decided to start reading about the Lusitania. And that's when I woke up.
Yeah. So what was there one particular part of the story or elements of the story that you figured, wait a minute, that's not the way the story is being told?
Well, one key element very early on struck me and really got my attention was that I realized that I shared this vast misconception about the Lusitania episode, and that was that Yeah, I think it's what is conveyed by the fact that it tends to get fairly short shrift in high school history courses and even college. And that is that you come away thinking that the Lusitania episode was essentially the World War I equivalent of Pearl Harbor. Yeah. It's not. It wasn't. Much to my surprise. I mean, what I found – and, you know, during my research, I would ask those friends who knew what I was working on. Those few friends, I tend to keep things pretty close to the vest. But those friends that knew what I was working on, I would ask them, so how long do you think it was between the time the Lusitania was sunk and we got into World War I?
Yeah.
And the answers ranged – I kept track. The answers ranged from about 2 days to 2 months. Well, it was in fact 2 full years.
Yeah.
2 full years. And when President Wilson finally asked Congress for a declaration of war, or to be more precise, a declaration that a state of war already existed with mm-hmm. Germany, he never once mentioned the Lusitania because so many other things had happened. And in fact, you know, I had a searchable version of the speech, and so I, you know, on at least 3 occasions, because I still doubted that this was actually could this possibly be true, and each, you know, I read the whole speech and I also searched the whole speech for Lusitania, and you know, no reference at all. I mean, it really surprised me.
You know what's so kind of weird about this story is the Woodrow Wilson's role, that he's in – and you tell the story – like, for example, if you look at the Pearl Harbor example, FDR goes on – you know, goes before Congress almost immediately, and there's this declaration, and he's – you know, he's furious. And Woodrow Wilson, like the first public statement he actually makes, he's kind of in this love trance. And we'll dig into that story as we go a little bit more, because it's really fascinating. But the way he equivocates, I mean, and I think it probably mirrored the way Americans were reluctant about this idea of war too. But his role in it is really strange and fascinating.
Well, his role is very, very interesting. But I think one thing we have to establish from the get-go is that Wilson was a very, very smart and very wise president about when it came to war.
Yeah.
He believed very deeply that America really was not ready for war, and really did not have a true perception of what real life war would really bring to the country. And so his restraint, I find really admirable. I mean, he really fought to keep America out of that war. And unfortunately, it was almost as though Germany at the time, even though, you know, the members of the hierarchy in Germany professed to not want America into the war, you know, between the time the Lusitania was sunk and when President Wilson asked for a declaration of war, it was almost as if they were doing everything possible to get America into it.
Yeah. So you don't see Wilson, and this comes through in the book, that you don't see him as this sort of dithering, lovesick person, but
not at all dithering, lovesick, absolutely.
Yeah, lovesick for sure. And but let's talk about that. His first wife dies, and it's he's struck. I mean, he's absolutely numb by the experience.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, she died, long, long marriage. She died in August of 1914, right, contemporaneously with the start of the war in Europe. And that really, really shook him. It left him really a crushed, lonely man, haunted by, you know, her ghosts, if you will, in the White House. That is to say, all the recollections and memories. I mean, he was just really a kind of a crushed man, still able to do his job, though, by all means, but certainly not having any fun doing it. In fact, there was one point where he took a walk with an advisor, and believe it or not, in Manhattan, you can take a walk, right, as president and advisor, and just try to not to be recognized.
He does that a couple of times. I was fascinated in that part of the story that he would go on this. He went on a walk after in the rain. We'll come back to that, but just the president of the United States wandering around.
Right, and after that, he confessed to his advisor when they went back to his apartment that he had sort of secretly hoped that while they were on that walk that somebody would have shot him, somebody would have killed him, you know, because he was so down about everything. Until one day he spots this beautiful widow, a woman named Edith Galt, and one thing leads to another. He falls absolutely, utterly in love with her. and begins writing these long, passionate love letters to her. I mean, it was just really incredible. Now, I am not the first person to discover these letters. These have been noted before in histories. But you know, I'm the first, I guess, to really bring them out as a as an important note of context in Wilson's life during this period, because, you know, it really was important to know about this. Now, these letters, this besottedness that he was experiencing happened even as the Lusitania was crossing the ocean. And to me, context is very, very important.
Yeah, no, I thought so too. And that what do you make of that moment when he says he was kind of in a trance when he gave that speech after the Lusitania had gone down? And I mean, that was I didn't know what to make of that.
I know. I was fascinated by that too. He gave a talk in Philadelphia, and later confessed to Edith Galt in another one of his multitude of letters that, you know, he had just been so out of it. If you know, he didn't use that term, of course, it's a contemporary term, but he was so out of it that briefly he forgot which city he was in. That he thought he was actually in New York, you know, and for him to be that lost in the world of love, I mean, that's very significant.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Lusitania. You mentioned as a ship, massive, of course, and built for speed. But this was something I didn't realize. It was also kind of built for war. I mean, how many people understand that? I mean, it was intended to have guns bolted to it initially.
Yeah. That was another interesting element of the story. The original deal to build the Lusitania and a sister ship, the Mauritania, it's one of the classic devil's bargains, if you will, but nobody, of course, knew it at the time. But, the Admiralty, which is the entity in Britain that was in charge of the Royal Navy, the Admiralty cut a deal with Cunard, which is the owner of the Lusitania, cut a deal with Cunard where in return for a very inexpensive loan, equivalent of billions of dollars today, for a very low interest loan, Cunard would have to agree to a number of things. One, the ships which would carry the Royal Mail had to be very, very fast. They had to prove that over speed trials that they could do 25 knots or better, and that's about 30 miles an hour. But they also had to be built in such a way that. If push came to shove and a war developed involving the sea, that these ships could be converted for military use, turned into what the term of art of the day was, that they could be converted into armed cruisers, armed naval cruisers, that is civilian ships armed with guns. To the extent that they actually were structured in such – built in such a way that they would have been able to have 12 large-ish naval guns installed on the decks. And in fact, the brackets, if you will, the so-called holding down rings for these guns were in fact installed on the decks of the Lusitania. The guns themselves, however, never were.
Right.
And that's a very important thing to know because thanks to a quite sensational account in the 1960s that speculated that claimed to have spotted – where a diver claimed to have spotted naval guns in the wreckage way down there at the bottom of the Irish Sea, there's been this perpetual belief that maybe the ship actually did have these guns, but it did not. But for more than that, the ship was also designed to, in effect – have the with a hull that mimicked the design of a battleship hull. In that era when the ship was conceived and built, coal was considered the equivalent of armor. It was helpful in blunting the impact of shells from enemy ships. And toward that end, the Lusitania was given what referred to as was built with what are referred to as longitudinal coal bunkers, which were unusual because they ran the entire length of each side of the ship, which is fine when they're full of coal. But if they're empty of coal, as if you have just finished a long voyage and suddenly penetrated by something like a torpedo, it can lead to catastrophic asymmetrical flooding. And we can talk about that.
Yeah, we will, because that's a clincher. It raises this question, though, whether or not what was the intent of the Lusitania. It raises the question of why it would be conceivable that the Germans would target passenger liners. Now, on some level, it seemed like the Germans could be said to have been justified in some way. The Brits had flown fake flags before. They were using, it seemed, these passenger ships to transport troops and munitions on passenger liners. So would you talk a little bit about this sort of German policy, how it is the Germans came to target passenger liners?
Well, the German strategy, there are a couple components to that question. The German strategy was to sink. You know, Germany recognized that Britain was an island nation and needed all the supplies it could get to sustain itself, from food to military equipment and so forth. And the way to stop the flow of that was to sink ships. Sink ships on the way to Britain, so that was their priority. The sinking of civilian liners was really sort of an example of mission creep, if you will. Yeah. You know, a number of things came to play. One is that first of all, they began sinking almost everything that entered the so-called war zone around the British Isles, and that included some cargo ships that also had passenger capacity. So that was one place where they began to push the limits of former maritime warfare restrictions, which banned attacking civilian vessels that carried passengers. Mm. And so there was that, and then of course there was the problem. The fundamental problem with submarines was that, you know, you had essentially a 20-something, you know, 28-year-old, 29-year-old, in the case of the U-20, a 30-year-old, yeah, in charge of a submarine with, you know, torpedoes and deck gun and so forth. And once that submarine was out of wireless range of its German base, which is essentially within the first 24 hours of patrol, it was entirely up to the commander of that submarine, this 28-year-old or 29-year-old or 30-year-old, whether to sink a ship or not. As one of the civilian leaders in Germany, who was deeply opposed to how Germany was prosecuting the submarine war, as he put it, he said, "You know, here we are giving a lone submarine commander the power to determine the outcome of the war." Meaning, of course, there was a good chance that an accident might happen that would draw America, you know, the 800-pound gorilla, into the war.
Yeah.
And so essentially it was up to, you know, the captain of U-20, Captain Walter Schwieger, when he saw the Lusitania coming over the horizon, it was up to him to decide what to do about it. And, you know, who knows what was going through his mind. Did he know it was the Lusitania? His log suggests that he did not, mm-hmm, although there is also some question as to whether that log was modified after he returned to his base. But it is almost inconceivable that he would not know it was the Lusitania. So what was on his mind? Probably tonnage.
Yeah.
You know?
It was big.
No, really, really. I mean, frankly, what brings to mind, bear with me, is a Gary Larson cartoon where two spiders have stretched a web at the base of a slide in a playground, just as a little kid is coming down, and the one says to the other, "If we pull this off, we'll eat like kings." And that's what Schwieger was thinking. Yeah. I think he was thinking, "This is going to make me, you know, put me over the top in terms of who is a submarine ace and who isn't."
He's an interesting character, Schwieger. I have to say, I'm not sure what to make of him from time to time. I mean, for example, maybe we should come back to this because I want to talk after the sinking. How he reacts is interesting. He's well liked by his crew. We should say that, and it couldn't have been pleasant in a German U-boat. I mean, that was one of the things you also talk about. We talked about experience earlier. What was it like to be in basically a submarine with three dozen men in leather clothing?
Right, exactly. So, yeah, you know, when I started this, first of all, one of the things that did convince me that, okay, maybe there's something I could add to the historiography of the Lusitania that was new, was when I discovered the captain had left this war log that is a very detailed narrative of his patrol. When I say discovered, I mean this was known to exist. But when I came across, and of course it was new to me, and what it also made me realize is, having done some advanced reading, that nobody had used this log to, I felt, maximum effect. Mm. What this log did was it provided immediately the architecture of suspense, if you will, because knowing that this vessel, knowing everything that this vessel was doing in the, you know, whatever 7 days leading up to its encounter with the Lusitania, and knowing, of course, exactly what the Lusitania was doing and everybody aboard during the 7 day crossing, and knowing that this is not going to have a good end when they meet each other in the Irish Sea, I mean, that's the essential nature of suspense. So when I realized that, I thought, okay, this is great. We're going to have the submarine converging and the ship converging. Mm-hmm. Now, what I had hoped was, that the submarine captain would turn out to be just this evil, malicious, cruel guy, like a Max von Sydow character, right, with a scar down the side of his face, you know, and a monocle, stuff. But in fact, I deeply believe that you have to go with what you've got. You have to look at things from the perspective of those who were alive at the time. I love nuance and I love warts. And what I got was lots of nuance and lots of warts. I mean, this captain, as you say, turned out to be, a very nice guy. Yeah. His crew loved him. He's 30 years old, blue eyes, handsome, funny, very humane in a sense. Yeah, at one point, he had 6 dachshunds aboard. You know, he was a dog person, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. And he was essentially making the best of it in this submarine with his crew. They were very close. The hierarchies of command were more blurred in a submarine. And he tried to make life as good as possible for his people. In fact, the submarine, one member of the crew referred to it as the happiest U-boat.
Yeah.
You know, and here's this guy, and he sets out from Germany. About the same time that the Lusitania sets out from New York, and he has a terrible time. He's encountering British destroyers. The weather is terrible. Fog, so much so that, when he arrives in the Irish Sea, he encounters more fog, which is very dangerous for submarines. It requires that they stay well under the sea so they don't get run over by ships. When he sees this, when he realizes that this is just like grinding to a really unhappy end here in the Irish Sea, he makes the decision to go home.
Yeah.
He had turned around.
It's so interesting, his response to the impact of the torpedo. And I don't know if I understand what to make of his response. He said that he saw panic on the deck of the ship, but
right,
and then basically, he couldn't bear to watch, and so he orders the U-boat to leave that area.
And almost immediately attacks another ship.
And that's what I was going to say. And everyone gets the sense that, I mean, one woman who said she was his fiancé, you report that Schwieger's fiancé said that he had been shattered by the experience. But it seems like you don't really buy that because, as you say, something like 5 minutes later, he's ready to attack another large ship.
Yeah, not only another large ship, but a civilian ship, but a liner also.
Yeah.
No, I don't buy for a second the fiancé's account. I think that was an effort to sort of massage history a little bit. Mm-hmm. And nor do I actually buy his – this is where history gets so interesting. You know, here's this war log, which is very, very detailed, very precise, and he has signed each page. At the end of each day, he had to sign the log, and that was essentially confirming that day's was done, and it's confirming that everything's real and so forth. So the whole log has the absolute sense of everything being really, really very, very, very accurate, very honest account of this voyage, until that interesting element in the log where he talks about, feeling remorse. Well, he doesn't talk about feeling remorse. He talks about all these people scrambling and how he couldn't – I'm paraphrasing badly – but how he couldn't fire another torpedo into that mass of humanity.
Yeah, said it was impossible.
Impossible.
And he's the one that did the first one. It's so strange.
I know. So, but there is speculation that this was a modification to the log after the fact.
Yeah.
And also, there is also a very interesting speculation that holds that Schwieger was as surprised as everybody that this ship went down as fast as it did.
Right.
There is one scenario that is talked about, and that is that, you know, maybe he decided to attack, hit it with one torpedo, knowing that he would sink it, but knowing that it would sink over hours and hours, and very likely everybody would have a chance to get off. But that was not the case. And frankly, one of the many elements, the many chance elements, and one reason that wasn't the case is because Schwieger blew it when he was firing the torpedo. He miscalculated the speed of the Lusitania. So the torpedo hit a place completely unexpected. He expected it to head elsewhere.
Eric Larson is with us. When we get back from a break, we'll talk about Captain William Thomas Turner, he was the captain, of course, of the Lusitania, another terrific character in this remarkable story. The book is Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Eric Larson is joining us to talk about his latest book, Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Let's talk about Captain William Thomas Turner. You say within the Cunard Company, he was really the best at handling large ships. He had managed to survive a rogue wave. That's a great story. And he was really good at fitting these big, massive ships into their slips pretty quickly. He was really good at what he did.
Yeah, he was very, very fast at that. He really exuded competence. You know, I like to make the analogy to you know, like if I had gone aboard the Lusitania that day in May when it set out from New York, and just about everybody who had booked passage, by the way, did go. Several decided not to because of a German warning that had been in the papers that very morning by coincidence. But if I had come across Captain Turner while coming aboard the Lusitania, I would have viewed him the way I tend to view, like where I listen for cues whenever I get onto an airplane. Like I said, I don't like to fly, so I'm always very tuned to what the pilot sounds like. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
I want
the guy who comes over to talks to me from the flight deck. I want him to sound like Robert Stack, not Woody Allen. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so this would be what Captain Turner was like, kind of a quiet, solid guy, you know, and absolutely capable. I mean, he had his problems, he had his errors in the past, but you know, all things considered, he was really the best of the best. He was not a terribly social captain.
Right.
He once to his beloved companion, housekeeper. Describe passengers as bloody monkeys, and because he was not suited to the social niceties of sea travel. In fact, the Lusitania had essentially a number two captain, so-called staff captain, as Turner put it, a more clubbable captain, the guy who had dinner with passengers at the captain's table, the guy who toured the decks and asked passengers nicely how their trip was going, and you know, and so forth, which of course was not at all what Turner was himself was into.
Yeah. What did Captain Turner know about the danger? You know, you talk about the fact that he was confident. He knew that this was wartime. He understood that in some ways. But this is a really important part of the story. British naval intelligence knew things that they didn't convey to people like Captain Turner.
Yeah, what Captain Turner embodied was the hubris of his era. He was absolutely confident that the Lusitania was so big and so fast that no submarine captain would ever catch him, let alone be able to torpedo the ship. And nor did he actually believe that any German submarine commander would be so callous as to attack a giant civilian liner. You know, the old rules of maritime warfare, you know, were beginning to erode thanks to Germany, but you know, it still seemed to be current. Problem was that you know, Turner went into this situation feeling, you know, a guy who was essentially trained in the old ways and the old mores of the sea and was about to encounter a situation for which his training did not apply. But it was also in the context, a much more disturbing context, and that is, you know, British naval intelligence through an entity called Room 40, a super secret entity that was founded very at the start of the war, actually, thanks to the nearly miraculous recovery on three different occasions of the German Navy's three most important code books, which is it's almost as if the fates wanted Britain to have this knowledge. So anyway, here's this Room 40, and Room 40 routinely read the wireless communications and, you know, decoded and deciphered them of the German Navy to and from its vessels and headquarters and so forth for really almost the duration of just about the entire war. Yeah. Almost every message that was sent.
Yeah.
So among these things, among these messages that was intercepted was were a lot of details over the, you know, first couple of years of the war about U-20, about Schwieger. There's a ledger that I came across that tracks exactly, you know, the paths of that U-20 took on its various patrols. But most importantly about this last patrol was that the Room 40 intercepted a message that identified exactly where U-20 was to be assigned for its patrol zone and exactly what it was supposed to do there. And that patrol zone was right off the mouth of the Mersey River at Liverpool, which was, you know, the zone through which all Cunard vessels passed. But this knowledge was never passed on to Turner or to Cunard.
You say in your book that there was silence on the subject of Room 40 in the UK. And this is what you write. You say, nowhere is there even a hint of dismay at missing so clear an opportunity to use the fruits of Room 40's intelligence to save 1,000 lives.
Right, right. Yeah, in all the materials that are archived about Room 40, it is really striking, the omission of anything having to do with the Lusitania. Now, that is not to say that at some point that documentary silence will change, because, you know, the British have this unfortunate habit of when they classify things, they mean business, and they have tended to make things secret for 100 years. And so what that means is that as we go ahead now, this year, you know, 2016, maybe more things will be declassified, 2017, 2018. So who knows what's going to be in those materials. But in the materials that are available thus far, there is no reference in the context of Room 40 to the Lusitania and the loss of the Lusitania, which I find very striking.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about May 7th. It's amazing what a beautiful day it was. And you talk about how that the smoothness of the sea, and this is the kind of scary part of the story, gave some passengers a view of the tornado. It was startling in its clarity.
Of the torpedo, yeah. No. Well, first of all, let's set up the day. Now, as I mentioned, I mean, Captain Schwieger was you know so fed up with the patrol, he was turning around to go home.
Right.
When suddenly the dense fog that had haunted him for really most of his patrol, suddenly the dense fog in the Irish Sea lifted.
Yeah.
Just suddenly lifted again, almost miraculously, and left this spectacularly clear day. You know, I don't know. Not just clear, but the sea absolutely smooth. The Irish coast vividly green and luminous in the distance, just 12 miles off. The only wind imparted, the only wind on the decks of the Lusitania that anybody felt was that imparted by the forward motion of the ship. You know, I don't know about you, but I tend to think about shipwrecks as happening at night, and
yeah.
I think I blame the Titanic film. You know, you know. But here it was, this beautiful, beautiful day, and I, you know, everybody. The sense I got from the research into survivor accounts was that, you know, at this point, people really felt that they were home free.
Right.
And they were starting to make remarks like, oh, whatever happened to this, the big threat, you know, whatever happened to this thing that we were supposed to fear. And then suddenly, there they are. You know, a number of passengers were actually on the deck, you know, looking out at the sea, just enjoying the view. And here comes this torpedo. One woman, this sort of sad voice, she says to a man, she says, "Is that a torpedo?"
Right.
his response was he just felt too sick to answer
her. Yeah.
But one guy, you know, this is the heroism of the age, I think, you know, that age of hubris and optimism. This one guy actually climbs up onto the rail so he can watch this thing as it approaches the ship. And it's, the sea is so clear, he is actually able to see the torpedo itself 9 feet under the surface of the sea, you know, this cylinder rocketing toward the ship with these gossamer trails of compressed air bubbles. And as he's watching, he says, it was a beautiful sight.
Yeah. That was an interesting part for me. You mentioned, I sort of referred to this in the introduction, there was little fear. There's a Oliver Bernard is one of the, you know, there's a whole litany of fascinating characters in the story that you write in detail about. But this Oliver Bernard said that people weren't terrified as much as astounded and then stunned, because I guess there was this realization then that the Germans had called their bluff, that this was actually happening.
Yeah, that really was it. That was it. It was just, they were just so startled that, oh my gosh, here it is. This thing that we had all sort of half expected has really come to pass. We're actually seeing this torpedo, and suddenly there's, of course, this tremendous impact. And another interesting element, though, is that one pervasive theme in survivor accounts is that there was no panic. It's very interesting because Schwieger in that final log entry refers to people clamoring and so forth. And so it's kind of interesting that he would say that. Now, maybe at that point when it was just before it was going under, there was actually at that point, you know, when the ship was going under bow first and you know, it was the classic thing where passengers were trying to scramble up to the end of the deck so that they could survive. He may have been seeing that. I don't know. But
Eric Larson, his latest book, Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Eric Larson. We're talking about his book, Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. So people are watching all this from the deck, and they could see it pass, as you say in the book, below the deck. And so there's this interval, which I found fascinating, where it seemed like nothing was going to happen, almost like, oh, it's a dud.
Because if you – I love that too, because, you know, if you're standing at a certain point on the deck – you know, the ship was so high, so tall. You know, like the top deck is like 60 feet out of the water, right? So if you think about perspective, let's say you're standing, you know, near the superstructure of the or even at the opposite side of the ship, and you see this track. It's going to be traveling a while out of sight of you until it makes impact. And it was during that period that people really had this sort of feeling like, you know, oh, what if? You know, what if it's just a dud, right? And which, frankly, was not that unrealistic. I mean, passengers were not aware of this, but in fact, as it turns out, 60% of during World War One, 60% of torpedoes failed.
Yeah,
60% failed. So even that was a fluky aspect. It actually worked.
Yeah. Wasn't there so much dumb luck involved in this story anyway? I mean, you know, just kind of. Timing, really terrible timing in some ways.
Just dumb luck. Yeah. I mean, so many, well, luck. I mean, just dumb. Yeah. I mean, so many forces, if you will. I love to think in terms of forces. So many forces converged on the Irish Sea that morning to make this disaster nearly inevitable. And yet if any one of those things had not happened, the outcome would have been very different. For example, the fact that the fog lifted so quickly and so utterly just before Schwieger, you know, spotted the Lusitania. Mm-hmm. You know, if the fog had lingered for an hour more, you know, who knows what would have happened. But also there were other factors involved, even something as simple as delay. Mm-hmm. You know, one salient point. I mean, there were many, many little delays.
A lot.
Like when the ship was departing, another ship, the Cameronio, was suddenly commandeered by the Admiralty to be used as a military vessel, which the Admiralty was empowered to do. Mm-hmm. Cameronio was in New York Harbor, and its passengers had to be transferred, so they were transferred to the Lusitania. It took about 2 hours. Then, as the Lusitania was about to leave, it turned out that the captain's niece, a quite famous at the time Broadway actress, was aboard to see him off, and the wharf crew had erroneously taken away all the gangplanks without letting her off. So they had to restore the gangplank so that she could get off the ship. That took time.
Yeah.
And the reason time is important is because, you know, there was this period where there was deep fog that would have shielded the Lusitania and forced the U-20 to stay submerged and even out to sea. But the biggest source of delay, the most interesting factor in the ultimate disaster, I think, was the fact that and so often tragedy can be led to an effort to economize. You know, the Cunard Company, in order to economize, had shut down one of the Lusitania's four boiler rooms. Now, when all four boiler rooms were in operation, the ship could maintain a top speed across the ocean of 25, even 26 knots, like I said, about 30 miles an hour.
Right.
With one boiler room out of operation, and by the way, these boiler rooms were gigantic, just huge. With one of these out of operation, the top speed the ship could attain was 21 knots. Now, that doesn't seem like that big a difference, 25 knots versus 21 knots. But when you spread that out over 24 hours, it essentially added an entire day to the voyage. If not for that economy measure, mm-hmm. the Lusitania would never have encountered U-20.
So explain what happens when 350 pounds of explosives detonates against the hull of this massive ship. I think what was so shocking to me was the fact that water is rushing in at 260 tons of water coming through just the portholes, 100 right. tons per second coming through this forced flooding. The fact that it sinks in 18 minutes was stunning.
Well, yes, and remember that Captain Schwieger, you know, hit a spot on the hull that he did not intend to hit.
Yeah.
This was a totally a fluky thing, and it happened to be the sweet spot to hit. But so what happened is, first of all, you know, another irony, such a beautiful day. Turner had ordered that all the portholes be closed because this is a logical precaution if you think there is a potential that the ship will be sunk, you know.
Yeah.
But because it was such a nice day, an estimated 70 portholes were open on the ship, on the starboard side alone. And if you think about 70 portholes, admitting I can't remember the exact figure, but I think something like 3.75 tons of water a minute or something like that. Anyway, when you add all that up, you've got a tremendous amount of water. Portholes are essentially a hole in the side of the ship.
Right.
All this water is flooding in. But more importantly was that there was a hole was blown in the side of the hull that was about the size of a small cottage, let's say. And the problem is because this thing just hit exactly the right spot, the impact was followed almost immediately by by a catastrophic disruption of the steam distribution system within the ship because water had flooded one of the boiler rooms. And when you have that happen, that that is really the ultimate disaster for one of these old coal-fired vessels. That disruption of the steam system has been because of all the conspiracies and conspiracists that have been in play ever since the sinking. There was always speculation that this was in fact caused by a secret stash of munitions. It was not. It was water water essentially intruding into this boiler room and disrupting the steam distribution system, blowing apparently the main steam distribution line, which is catastrophic. It's catastrophic. But most importantly, what it did was it killed the engines.
Yeah.
It killed the engines and the electric dynamos on the ship. So what that meant was that when you have a ship like this that's traveling at this point it was traveling at 18 knots. When you have a ship traveling at 18 knots and your engines are out, you can't stop it. Mm-hmm. You can't stop it. And you have to stop it if you're going to try to lower any lifeboats. So this thing is moving along at 18 knots, and that's the forced flooding. This hole, water is not just flowing in. It's flowing in at an exaggerated rate. So much so that it is flooding apparently the longitudinal bunkers. It's flooding a forward empty. Remember everything – because this is the end of the voyage, all these coal bunkers are mostly
empty. Yeah.
So water is filling the forward bunker. Water is filling the longitudinal bunkers. And what's happening then is because, of the way this thing was built, it was this sort of battleship-like hull, the water is filling it in an asymmetrical way so that the ship suddenly takes on a profound list to the starboard side, to the right side, 25-degree list. So now if you can imagine that, suddenly the ship is listing 25 degrees, still moving through the water. It's got plenty of lifeboats thanks to the Titanic disaster, but the lifeboats, using them, has suddenly become very problematic. Because if you think about it, the lifeboats on the left side are next to unusable because they want to swing into the superstructure. And these are heavy, heavy boats. You can't move these unless you got like 10 men trying to push them out.
Right.
And meanwhile, the lifeboats on the starboard side have swung out so that what would ordinarily be a hair-raising, effort to board these things, 60 feet above the sea, now is downright terrifying because these lifeboats on the right side have swung out from the ship, 8 to 10 feet. So you got to cross that space somehow to get into these boats.
Or fall 60 feet.
Or fall 60 feet, yeah. Now, a lot of people began to opt for the jumping path. That is, of course, after the ship began to go down and that distance became less than 60 feet. But still, even then, people were just deciding, no, none of these boats for me. I'm jumping.
Boy, so much in this story we didn't get to. I'm glad we didn't get to the fate of Captain Turner. That's a good part of the story that you can learn when you read Dead Wake, the question of Winston Churchill's role in all of this, all of the conspiracy theories. Eric Larson sort of deals with all of that. The idea of grief and how people responded to this. So much in this story. Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Eric Larson, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. This is really enjoyable. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.